They're gonna ride till there ain't no place to go. Look at them grow. I don't even know the lyrics in that song. Am I even partially correct?
I think. Crackling Rose. I don't really know the chorus of that.
Crackling Rose, get on board.
That's all I know of any Neil Diamond song. I only really know the chorus.
You just have to have that like little Will Ferrell affectation with it, and then it becomes... It's not even Neil Diamond. It's Will Ferrell's version of Neil Diamond.
Yes, which is the definitive version. Same with, who is that, Robert Goulet?
Yeah.
Like, I don't really know what Robert Goulet sounds like. I know who he is, but I'll only really know him through the prism of Will Ferrell.
Because I love... And if you ever see the Gap commercials, I mean, they're hard to find. I wish they'd bring those puppies back. But I think he does Cracklin' Rose. Yeah, it's one of the Gap commercials. Look at them grow. You're going to ride till there ain't no place to go.
Look I really at, don't like Cracklin' Rose.
Yeah, there's some other song that he does for, Forever in Blue Jeans, of course, for the Gap. Forever in Blue Jeans, yeah. That's what he cuts out with him, just sitting on that white stool. I love that Gap. That Gap commercial series was fantastic.
Right. It probably cost them a whole lot of money.
Yeah, that was really good.
Way more than like 13-year-old girl walking in jeans, like Will Ferrell singing like a song they have to license from Neil Diamond.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Hey, welcome to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. This is the show that you are listening to. That is Mike. Mm-hmm. I am Clayton. And by the way, we want to thank our two show sponsors right off the top because we got a little something coming up a little bit later in the show we're going to tell you about. A chance to win something. So our thanks to Tonks Coffee, the world's best coffee, shipped right to your door. These guys are incredible. Go check them out at tonx.org. And we're going to tell you a little bit later in our Tonks ad as we talk about it, how you can win a Google Nexus 7 tablet for free. You don't have to do anything. It's all free. You're just going to sign up for Tonks Coffee for free. No obligation. Try it out. And we'll tell you how you can enter that. Plus, our friends over at Cobra Electronics, makers of some of the world's best things to improve your lifestyle, right? The new Cobra Eye Radar is out.
Oh, it is, finally.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's not out. It's out in April, but I got to see it.
Oh, come on. You're killing me.
I got to see it. It is fantastic. So, and I just used the new Cobra Vedetta, V-D-E-T-T-A, the world's best radar system. I got to drive up with the up to the Poconos the other day, and I think it saved me from like two tickets. Speed trap area. This woman's sultry voice comes on. Speed trap area, and sure enough, I came around the corner, and there was a guy right there. There was a cop right there tagging people. So we'll tell you about those a little bit later in the show. How are you doing?
I wonder. This should get like you know who I think of having a voice like that. You know the jazz singer Melody Gardot. Like, they should get her to do the voice for the Vedetta system, you know, that's very soothing to you.
I would like that. I would like to wake up to that kind of a voice.
Mm-hmm. Right, like Melody Gardot singing to you.
Right. Actually, I want to play
this. Wake up, Clayton. Wake up. Oh, that's so peaceful.
I want to play something for you. I got a voicemail. Are you familiar with, how familiar are you with the Oak Ridge Boys?
I have like a vague sense of them. Didn't they like recently, since George Bush Sr.'s like in the hospital, didn't they go sing to him to make him feel better or something?
Indeed they did. So here's what happened to me. I said
I was sick.
I was in the hospital.
The Oak Ridge Boys came over.
Close. I'm actually digging to find this right now. My email client is grinding to a halt as I dig for this. But I was reporting that story. And it was so the Oak Ridge Boys, you know, George Bush Sr. is a big fan of the Oak Ridge Boys. And he was in the hospital laying there, and the Oak Ridge Boys got on the phone and they sang to him. They sang a couple of songs, Elvira being one of their big hits. I think that's their biggest hit, right?
Of course. Like, yeah, if I was going to name one Oak Ridge Boys song, I don't think I could name another. There's just Elvira, right?
Right. But, you know, like, and I said after the segment, I said, oh, that's gotta put you in some, put you in some good mood, of course. And they, you know, he ended up getting better. The president got better. And I joked during the segment, I said, I want to change my voicemail so that the guy from the Oak Ridge Boys with the deep voice, Richard, I want him to do my voicemail message. How awesome would that be, right?
Yeah.
He's the guy that goes like, boop, 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 boop. You know, I can't, there's no way you can even get your voice that low.
Mm-hmm.
So listen to this. Here's a little surprise. Here's what he actually did for me. Listen.
Mm.
Hello. Yes, you have reached Clayton's voicemail. But no, this is not Clayton's voice. This is Richard Sturban of the Oak Ridge Boys. Leave a message for my friend Clayton, and he will be glad to call you back. Boom, papa, boom, papa, mow, mow.
Isn't that amazing?
And how did you manage this exactly?
They surprised me. My producers, they surprised me on the air about it. Because then, you know, the president got better. He was feeling better and whatnot. And I love that. I love that.
Hello. Yes.
Have you made that your voicemail yet?
But no, this is not Clayton's voice.
No, I haven't. I haven't. You know, it's weird because it's an MP3 file. I need to drag it into iTunes. Actually, because it's a voicemail. It's not like it's a ringtone. And I was thinking, I just had it up my, I had it up my head. In, you know, I was like, oh, I'll just drag it right in iTunes and make it a ring. I'm like, no, it's not a ringtone. It's a voicemail. So I need to like set my phone up next to my speakers and record it that way. So I got to do that.
He couldn't come to your house to do it, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't hand him my phone to have him do it. But that, I think that'll be my thing, right? Anytime I meet a celebrity from now on, which is regular, right? Like when I hang out with you.
Yeah.
I'll get celebs to, and I say celebs because I don't have time to say the full word. I'll get them to record a voicemail message for me from now on. That'll be my new thing. Why not, you know?
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. Although this year
who are you going to be meeting upcoming? Like, do you know who's on the docket?
You know, it's funny. I just looked at my email here. Like, we had, like, Brad Meltzer on the show. That'd be kind of fun to have on. Who do we have on the other day? We had, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I just got to meet him the other day.
Oh, that sounds like a voicemail waiting to happen.
I would
and
love
I'm sure
that.
He's not busy.
Right. But he, you know, he was right there in the hallway. He could have done it. Hello. You've reached Clayton's voicemail. You know, it's kind of a cross between Arnold and Vladimir Putin, I think, but I just love this, and it's so no one ever calls me anyway, and if they call me, it's like the heating company calling to like confirm their Tuesday appointment to come out and fix a furnace, right? It's no one like cool calling me. So it's like, yeah, we got to call Clayton Morris to confirm our appointment with him to come out and fix his. We're gonna give him a call right now. He's on our docket of people to call. Let's call him. Okay.
Hello. Yes, you have reached Clayton's voicemail. But no, this is not Clayton's voice.
They're going to be like, what the heck is this? Oh, I can't wait.
Well, it was very nice of them to do that for you.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
The Oak Ridge Boys.
That's pretty cool.
They're getting up there in years, those Oak Ridge Boys. Have you seen like a recent photo of them?
Oh, yeah, and their beards are incredibly long.
Right, man. They got like ZZ Top plus.
I know, I feel like it would get to be a hassle to get a beard that long.
Yeah, you think. Especially if you like soup.
Yeah, I would think soup or any pureed food. Like, you know, and especially if you're getting old, right? You might not have all your faculties, all your mandibular faculties anymore. So you'd probably need to eat food through a straw, or it must need to be mushy, and probably be getting up in that, you know, your flavor saver quite a bit, I think.
I do not disagree with what you're saying.
Like Santa. It's hard for him to eat all those cookies. All those crumbs are hidden in there.
Does ZZ Top still tour? Like, do they still go out in public?
I think so. I think I always see them, like, listed on a concert spread for some summer concert stuff. You know, you'll see it, you know, coming to the Georgia Festival or the Iowa State Fair, ZZ Top.
Right.
You know, she's got
There was like
legs.
Sharing a bill with REO Speedwagon.
Right.
You know, like it's them and the remaining members of Styx and Foreigner I can't think of that. Lou Gramm is the lead singer of Foreigner.
And the Journey cover band.
I so want to go see, I know we've said this now probably for as long as we've been doing the Grizz. I would love to go see Journey with that new lead singer of theirs, that Filipino boy.
Oh, and this is the guy that they discovered on YouTube?
Yes, I would love to go see him. As cool as it would be, you know, to see Steve Perry actually singing the hits that he made famous, you know, Steve Perry doesn't go on the road. You can't go see Steve Perry, but Journey you can still go see. You know, Neil Sean and the boys, they still go on tour. But they found this kid, they watched a YouTube video of him singing a Journey song, and he sounds unbelievably like Steve Perry, where I think if you turned your back and listened to them, you would think that it was Steve Perry singing. That's uncanny.
That's usually how I listen to Journey. I turn my back.
Now, you don't like Journey. Like, I know we've talked about this before. There's something about Journey that you don't like. And I want to say this, that Journey was one of those 80s groups where I was like, I'm not into them. I'm just not into Journey. I don't know why. Like, something about them didn't really grab me. But then, like, one year as a gift, I got, like, a double disc career retrospective of them during a period of time when they were not together. I think this is before they recruited that weirdly named Steve O'Jerry guy to replace Steve Perry, who both sounded and kind of looked like him. And I started to like their stuff. Like, I couldn't deny it. Like, Don't Stop Believing and Separate Ways and Lights and Wheel in the Sky. And little by little, like, I became a Journey fan. But you really dislike Journey.
I don't know. I mean, there's some songs that, you know, I don't mind. So there are a few songs that if they come on when I'm listening to, like, Sirius, you know, the 80s station on Sirius, and they have a heavy rotation of Journey songs that come through there.
Yeah.
I don't mind them. Maybe they're growing on me a little bit. And there are there's like one or two of their songs that I do like. Maybe you can help me out. And I just don't pay attention to them because I'm like, oh, it's Journey. But I don't mind that song. Yeah, that's okay. But most of their stuff drives me nuts, and I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the – that's the kind of 80s style that I don't like.
Well, you know, sometimes they get thrown into that, like, corporate rock category that people later – you know, people tried to say that about Boston, the latter period ELO stuff. You know, they say, like, this was just music that was being made to please their corporate masters and not please an audience. But you know what? Like – Journey had chart hit after chart hit after chart hit. So to deny their popularity as it relates to, like, you know, consumers is foolhardy. But I get that. I feel that way sometimes about some stuff from Foreigner. And I like Foreigner, too.
Yeah. I think that's that REO Speedwagon to me.
I really dislike REO Speedwagon.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to distinguish them. You know, I feel like REO Speedwagon, Foreigner, Boston a little bit, Air Supply.
Really? Air Supply I think is very different. Like, their sound is so soft rocky.
Yeah, but they've got some latter stuff that has, like, that Foreigner sound to it. I'm trying to think what else falls into that category for me.
Let me ask you this. Can you name a couple Foreigner songs that you do like? Foreigner songs.
Yes. Let me see. Let me get my Foreigner list out here because – I can't name them off the top of my head.
I'll tell you one I really like. Jukebox Hero.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of my favorite Foreigner songs.
Yeah.
Waiting for a Girl Like You.
Oh, that's I love that song. That's one of my favorite Foreigner songs. Mm-hmm. Waiting for a Girl Like You is actually on, you know, on my best of 80s list. I don't mind Double Vision.
Right. Cold as Ice, I like. I actually kind of knew that song before I knew it because of that Dana Carvey bit on SNL. You know the one I'm talking about, Chopping Broccoli?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, he's basically, you know, lampooning that song in a way, Cold as Ice.
I do like, I really like the song Urgent.
Yeah.
Yep. So there are some, I'm not as much of a Foreigner hater as I was Journey. And I know, you know, Journey is one of those bands that people just, they go nuts for.
Right. Well, they were one of the first real true arena rock bands, I think.
Yeah.
You know, that they packed, you know, baseball stadiums and things like that for people to see Journey, and their sound was kind of made for it. I do want to say this, too. I really like Lou Gramm's solo stuff away from Foreigner. I think Midnight Blue and Just Between You and Me are, like, two of the best underplayed 80s singles there ever were. Boston, I really have no connection to. I only know that one song of theirs, Amanda. I couldn't tell you anything else about Boston. Everything I know by REO Speedwagon, I dislike. And I'll tell you another band, not just because they now seem to tour infinitely with them, but I used to feel that way about Styx.
Yeah.
And then I got, like, a collection of Styx stuff, and I really liked it. I only really knew, like, Mr. Roboto and Come Sail Away. But when I listened to this Styx retrospective, suddenly I realized I knew a lot of Styx songs.
Yeah, trust me. And, you know, growing up listening to, like, classic rock radio all the time, like WYSP out of Philadelphia, like, I know a lot of Styx songs. I don't own any of them. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why I just know them so well from having heard them on the radio. You know, I think you'd know a lot of Boston songs. I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit. If you heard it, like, I want to try to think, like More Than a Feeling.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Let me think what else. Like, don't look.
You got to really think.
I know.
Boston had a lot of hits.
You said Amanda already, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you'd know more, Higher Power.
Maybe.
And I think you'd know, I think it's Don't Look Back. Don't Look Back. Okay. I think you'd recognize some of their stuff. But, you know, I feel like some of these bands get lumped into this weird category that I liked some of the other bands that could also probably fall into this category, like Kansas.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Kansas and Boston do get lumped together for obvious reasons.
Yeah. So, but I did like, you know, I had Kansas's greatest hits, Carry On Wayward Son, Dust in the Wind. So I think some of there's a lot of bleed over. I don't know that there's any rhyme or reason to why I'm so passionately opposed to certain sectors of this, what you would call corporate rock, I guess. But, you know, because I feel like Yes, Supertramp, Kansas could fall into that same category. And I had Supertramp's greatest hits. I had Journey's greatest hits that my uncle had given me on a cassette. I never really listened to it. Mm-hmm. And Kansas's greatest hits, but I did not own Boston, Styx, Foreigner, or like REO Speedwagon.
Right. Now, Supertramp, their hit is The Logical Song, right?
That's their most famous song. Yeah, yeah. The Logical
I do
song.
Not like Supertramp.
Yeah.
I will go to bat for Yes. You threw them in there, Yes. And Yes is kind of like the maybe most commercially successful progressive rock band of all time. They are like the hardcore prog rockers.
Yeah,
and
I don't think
that they fit into the category with the other ones. You know, Kansas sometimes even gets kind of nabbed as being a little bit of a progressive rock band. But Yes, more than anybody else, I think, they're really on a different spectrum than Journey and Foreigner. And Yes really only had two or three commercial hits. In the 80s, they had changed their lineup a bit. And they were getting away from kind of like their crazy concept albums and prog rock type stuff. And they had those commercial successes with Owner of a Lonely Heart, which is
right.
Probably, if you only know one Yes song, that's the song you know. And then they had like a follow-up hit called Rhythm of Love. And they were like, they were almost like made to be radio hits. And I think it was because they had changed their lineup. And maybe, I'm just guessing, I'm not super up on their history, is that maybe they were in danger of losing their recording contract and they needed a more commercial album, which they dropped in the mid-80s. But if you go back and I have a collection of Yes songs.
And I have some bootlegs at my buddy who was a huge Led Zeppelin fan. I mean, he had every piece of Led Zeppelin music. Plus, I think he had so many bootlegs from their concerts in the 70s. It was a guy that I worked with at the WB Network out in Pittsburgh. He was the production manager. He was a big Yes fan. So he had made me a tape of some classical Yes music. Maybe it's from their albums from the 70s, but it's beautiful. I mean, you'd almost think like it was Bach, you know,
right.
It was like beautiful classic, classic acoustic guitar, really fast, really good
right.
stuff.
Their lead guitarist, Steve Howe, is generally regarded as like a true virtuoso on guitar. And, I think that the 70s is kind of what's considered the golden period of Yes. So if you want, I'll compile for you a handful of songs, maybe by, I'll handpick a couple Journey tracks for you, a couple Yes songs, a couple of those, and I'll send them to you.
Okay.
And I'll see if I can't turn you on to some of that. But
I'll do the same with some Supertramp, because I think I'd be surprised. You don't like The Logical Song. But there are something
about that song really does drive me up the wall.
I'm not a fan of that song, but I had the greatest hits, and I was a fan of, you know, there's some other stuff in there, like Take the Long Way Home. Breakfast in America, Give a Little Bit.
Give a Little Bit, okay.
Yeah, you know Give a Little Bit, right? Play a little. Give a Little Bit.
Right, sure.
Goodbye Stranger. There's some good Supertramp stuff. I was a fan of those guys.
Yeah. We can agree, I think, that we'll never go see REO Speedwagon.
Right.
We're never going to go see them. I would not go see Styx. You know, Dennis DeYoung, the lead singer, doesn't tour with them anymore. They've replaced him because the other guys wanted to tour. And they famously, because, you know, one of the big points of division within the group was their 80s album Kilroy that contains the song Mr. Roboto, which I think you could maybe make the argument is one of their two biggest hits. And they hated that album. That was like Dennis DeYoung's idea about this dystopian future inhabited by robots. So because that was such a point of division within the band, now that they've gotten rid of Dennis DeYoung, they do not play anything off of Kilroy. So if you go to see Styx now, they don't play Mr. Roboto. Which
do they play?
I don't know where
Come
who was telling me this story, but it's like a huge thing among like the Styx purists that want them to play that like they all bring signs like for Kilroy and wave them in the audience because they want them to play those songs, and of course the band won't.
Do they play like Come Sail Away? I mean, I would hope they would.
Sure. The only hit from the Kilroy album was Mr. Roboto. The other songs by them that you know, they all precede or, you know, succeed that. But I think that's really when the band started to break apart. So that's all interesting. You brought something up, and I want to share this bit of information that I learned because I think I misspoke about this episodes ago. I'm currently reading a book that I was given for Christmas called The Revolution Was Televised. And I was turned on to this book thanks to my pal Clayton Morris, who sent me an excerpt by the author, whose name escapes me at the moment. But in the book, he talks about the television series Lost.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you had sent me the excerpt that was published, wherever the heck it was published, which is about half of the chapter on Lost. He discusses maybe 12 or 14 different revolutionary television shows, which kind of changed the way people look at drama on TV, coming off of a spell of incredible monotony on television. And he talks about Lost, and he talks about Breaking Bad, he talks about the reinvented Battlestar Galactica, and lots of series that you and I have enjoyed and have discussed here on the program. So it's been very, very interesting to read. One of the things that he talks about is the television series Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which was the brainchild of Joss Whedon, who, of course, most recently directed The Avengers. And I didn't realize that the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I'm sure you remember this, was that movie with Luke Perry in it from like the really early 90s. That was the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Is this author Joe Trippi? Revolution?
No. The guy's last name is like Seppenwall or something like that.
Okay, because he had written a book called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised by Joe Trippi.
Right. This is The Revolution Is Televised or whatever. It's a playoff of that title.
Gotcha.
The Revolution was televised by Seppenwall. Mark Seppenwall, Steve Seppenwall, whatever his name is. Anyway, he has a lot of followers on Twitter. I was astonished for a TV critic. Anyway, that original Buffy the Vampire Slayer was also by Joss Whedon. It's just that the director really changed it a lot and got away from his core concept, which he then got right on the television series, which ran for, you know, how many seasons, that had Sarah Michelle Gellar, or Geller, depending how you think her last name is pronounced.
Right.
And this was the point that came up in the book that I did not realize, and maybe you knew this because you work in television, but I didn't, was that the WB network, or excuse me, the CW network, is the combined WB and UPN.
Yeah, yeah.
I did not realize that they merged into one and became the CW.
Yeah, and I worked there at the time when that happened. The merging of these networks. You know, The Daily Buzz, the show, the morning show that I worked on years ago, started as a syndicated product, and it was mostly on WB affiliates. We were on some UPN affiliates scattered around the country, and then a few Fox affiliates in some small markets. And then they merged and became the CW, and it became a huge hit, right? The CW became a big hit with the younger audience. They kind of got, I think it's safe to say, the UPN crowd, they had more urban shows, urban comedies.
Is that a euphemism for shows starring black actors?
I guess, is that the term? I don't know what you'd call, I mean, it was like, that's what they would call it,
but
right?
But that's exactly what it said in the book. Like, I was laughing as I read it. They were like, this was the network that was meant to appeal to African Americans, and this is the network that was meant to appeal to whiteys like us. And then they had to combine and figure out what the new mix would be.
Right. Yeah, and that's what it was. Yeah, so
that might come as a shock to some loyal eggheads, but both Clayton and I are white.
Right.
I know as you listen to this, you're probably like, you know, it's really difficult to tell. It's really hard to tell. I think Mike, you know, he could be like from Pakistan.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Given my accent.
And given your weird food likes that you're into.
Right. And, you know, when I listen to you, Clayton, I just kind of think, like, that guy, like, Vietnamese?
Mm-hmm.
Is he Thai?
It's hard to say.
And I've seen your face.
Like a northern region of Thailand?
Yeah, right. Like you don't have any of the facial characteristics that I associate with those countries.
I'm from Nepal. So you're enjoying...
I don't know anyone from Nepal.
But you said you wanted to correct something? Did you
right,
do that?
Like, yes, I did. Like, I had I did not fully understand what had happened to those networks. And I know, like, in the last 20 episodes or so, I said something that was false about that. They merged and became the CW. It's not that one, you know, one died and the other took its place and rebranded or whatever. They merged and became the CW.
Hmm. Yeah, this book sounds interesting. And the excerpt on the Lost chapter was fascinating.
It's been very, very good. Like, everything about it, he writes extensively about The Sopranos, about Oz, about The Wire, about Deadwood.
What does he say about Deadwood? I mean, I wouldn't mind reading this book as well, but I'm...
Well,
you know,
I'll tell you, because that is one of three series in the book I've never watched, I'm not reading the chapter because they spoil everything about the series.
Hmm.
Like, he talks about everything, like what happens in the series finale. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's riddled with spoilers. So because I would like to think that maybe one day I'll have time to watch Deadwood, I'm not reading that chapter of the book.
Gotcha.
But, like, I did kind of come to terms with the fact that I'm never going to watch all 8 seasons of 24. So right. I read that. Like, I'm never going to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV series. So I read that one. And I know there's a chapter upcoming about Friday Night Lights, which I've never watched, which I think is like a football show.
Right. That's supposed to be very good as well.
Right. But, yeah, it's very good, and he's extremely authoritative. And I believe he's roughly our age. He's a TV critic that went to Penn in Philly, and I got the vibe from, you know, when he was, what TV shows were on when he was in high school versus when he was in college. I get the vibe that he's roughly our age.
So the New York Times says this about his book. Mr. Sepinwall's book, which was self-published, by the way, has all the immediacy and attention to detail that has won his blog so many followers. It also stands as a spirited and insightful cultural history. The New Yorker says this. So when I picked up Allen's terrific new self-published book, The Revolution Was Televised, by which I mean when I downloaded it onto my phone and scrolled nonstop for 2 days, I knew it would be good. And it is. The book is smart, substantive, walk through the past 15 years of television drama, making a lucid case for the Arturist mentality among modern showrunners. And, you know, it's interesting, I think, because currently there's a move and there's a shift taking place on broadcast television as it relates to trying to get to some of these successful cable dramas. So broadcast television, seeing the success of Breaking Bad, Mad Men on AMC, Justified on FX, which, by the way, just started in episode 2. It is so good again this season. Broadcast television realized it needed to do something. It needed to shift its thinking on television dramas. That's why you're starting to see The Following, the Kevin Bacon television show that's now on Fox, with a big marketing push behind it, of course. And I don't know that I've ever seen such a big marketing push for any of these other shows. I don't think that they had the money to do it. Mad Men, Breaking Bad kind of came on like, you know, kind of quiet, right? But The Following, you know, you'll see him on, he was on Howard Stern the other day. He was on, he's on the Today Show. He's on Letterman. He's all over the place. Of course, Kevin Bacon's a big star. But so that series is exactly an answer to these successful new cable dramas, which, by the way, have you seen yet? The Following?
I've seen the billboards, but that's all I know.
Yeah. I haven't seen it either.
Yeah, but one of the things he does bring up, and I think he's right on the money about it. He talks about the fact that people who stayed with Lost from start to finish, like you and I did, and people that stayed with Battlestar Galactica from start to finish, both felt like the series finale somehow betrayed their trust as viewers. And he said that this sometimes becomes a trap of the science fiction genre, in that people want really concrete answers to the end of the stories, and both of them give very metaphysical, more spiritually based resolutions to their stories. And there is definitely a group of people, and I think I am counted among them, as I found both of those series finales to be dissatisfying, is that people don't want their metaphysical mixed with their sci-fi. And I thought he put that very, very well in the book. It was interesting to me, and I'll tell you this little bit about the difference between Lost and Battlestar Galactica in their creative process, was that, and this is one thing that comes up again and again in this book, which I thought was fascinating. It's true of The Sopranos, it's true of The Wire, it's true of Oz, Lost, Battlestar, etc. The people behind it, the creators, all thought that the series would never actually get made.
Right.
They wrote the pilots and said, no one is ever going to buy this because it's, for this reason, that reason, the budget, the creative, the direction, the tone, you know, this is so bleak. Like with Battlestar, that's one thing that comes up again and again in that chapter, is that it was such a bleak series. And they just said, no one's ever going to pick this up. And they'd get to the end of their first season and say, no one's ever going to renew this, and they'd get renewed. And so what's interesting about that is the creators of Lost, I think, and they kind of come clean and say that they had falsely, they lied to the audience a number of times. Like when they said, we know exactly where we're going with this story and blah, 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 they were bluffing.
Yeah.
When they said that there's not going to be any supernatural or mythological elements to this series, they were bluffing. They were saying these things publicly because there were people at their network who they had made agreements with, like, no, there won't be anything supernatural in Lost. And they were lying to them to get the series to go. So what's interesting about it is, when Lost got picked up for its second season, they took all the writers away for like a weekend summit somewhere and plotted out the whole mythology of the show. Because at the end of season one, they never thought they were going to get picked up again.
Right,
and
even
then
after
they
the
realized they have to invent this whole show that they've been telling everybody all along that they had figured out.
I think, and we were popular, we were purveyors of that information even on this show. We were talking about, right? Hey, oh, you know, we should just relax because they know where they're going. Mm-hmm. Right? Everything will be fine. They know where they're going. And even after the first episode, the pilot, and I recall from having read that excerpt from that chapter where he says, you know, we watched it, and then he got the ratings returns, mm-hmm. and they said, oh, does this mean that we have to do another show?
Right.
Does this
right.
mean
and, you know, the same was true of virtually every one of these series, that was the feeling from the creators, like the creators of The Shield, for example, that he talks about with great reverence, which I've never watched. You know, he talks endlessly about how they'd get to the end of every season and be like, there's no way we're getting picked up again. And they'd get picked up again. Well, with Battlestar, you know, they had said that the mantra, the creative team's mantra was, this is not Star Trek, this is not Star Wars. That's what they wanted to kind of guide their creative process. Like the conventions that you see on those shows, because I didn't realize this, but a lot of the people that wrote for Battlestar Galactica were ex-Star Trek Next Gen writers.
Really?
And, yeah, and some had worked on Deep Space Nine and Voyager as well. In fact, they were responsible for shaping the series. Hmm. And the main guy, whose name escapes me right now, that was behind Battlestar Galactica, said, we were literally making it up as we went. We would just create an interesting idea in one episode with no sense of how that would pay off or impact later events. And he said one of them was, you know, when do you remember the name of the Cylon that's played by Grace Park? She's the Asian actress in the cast. Boomer, right? She's Boomer.
Boomer, yeah. Oh no, is that the guy? Her boyfriend, Boomer.
No, yeah, I don't think so. I think she was Boomer.
Let me look it up. You know, it's so odd because I was watching Hawaii 5-0 for the first time the other night after one of the football games, and she is she's in that show. Mm-hmm. It's weird.
The guy, Jin from Lost, is on Hawaii 5-0, isn't he?
Yes. He plays a police officer in that, yeah.
Yeah, so Grace Park, who I think played Boomer, she was excellent in that role. She's very good. Everybody in Battlestar is very good, though. I don't want to just single her out. They had an awesome cast.
Yeah, Mary McDonnell.
One of the real surprises of that whole series was Trisha Helfer, who plays like the lead Cylon, who previous to that, with like no acting experience, had only been an underwear model.
She's great.
And she's fantastic in that series.
Yeah, Boomer. But, yeah, Lieutenant Sharon Boomer Valeri is Grace Park.
Right. Yep, Sharon. So he said about how there's a scene where a second Sharon shows up to help, you know, whoever that human, her human boyfriend was. At this point, they hadn't revealed that she was a Cylon. And they said, how are we going to explain that there's a second one of her? And they were kind of like, we'll figure it out later. You know, so I really kind of like that he was like, yeah, we were really just flying by the seat of our pants a lot of the time. And he said it was really just kind of meant as like a an allegory for a lot of things that we felt about what was going on in a post 9/11 world. And, you know, that was the forefront of it. And the second concern then was maintaining some kind of continuity. And I thought that was really, really intriguing. And it has been thus far a very enjoyable book, and I'd be more than happy to loan it to you when I'm done with it, which won't be much longer because I think I only have 2 chapters left.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, I'm wrapping up my book Gettysburg right now for my book club. So,
And what's that about? Is that about 2 teenage girls in bikinis that rob a burger joint?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, summer love, and James Franco comes to save, bail them out of prison.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Hey, listen, in a little bit,
yeah,
we are going to tell you how you can win. It's going to cost you not a dime, a Galaxy Nexus tablet device by Google. Isn't that right, Clayton?
Indeed.
But yeah. Before we do that, we're going to pause right here and tell you a little bit about one of our great show sponsors. They are my friends and yours, although they are foes of G.I. Joe, Cobra Electronics. And as Clayton said at the top of the show, they are makers of gadgets to simplify your life. Now, we've talked a lot about the iRadar device here, which is it alerts you about speed traps, radar and laser detection, red light cameras, all kinds of driving hazards, and it makes you a safer and more alert driver. We've told you about this. You know, they upgraded that system to Clayton's Vedetta that you heard him talk about just a little bit earlier, which is even more user-friendly. It mounts very easily on your dashboard. It's got an easy-to-read display. In addition to giving you, you know, you can hear what it has to say as well as reading it on the screen, which is a little bit of a difference versus using the dashboard on your smartphone device that comes with the iRadar. But we've talked about the Cobra Tag as well, have we not, Clayton? The two-way locator system, which can be used in a variety of ways. You know, the potential of something like that, the Cobra Tag system, if you want to put it on a piece of luggage that you're worried about, you want to put it on your dog's collar that always runs away, it's a great two-way locator system. And here's the way it works, if you haven't heard us describe this amazing innovation of theirs before. It pairs with your smartphone. So if this Cobra Tag fob that you put on your dog's leash, or you put it on your briefcase or your laptop bag or your keys, if you always misplace your keys, you can call it from your phone. And if it's out of range, like you can't hear it, it'll draw you a map to where it is. Like, that's astonishing. That's absolutely astonishing. But, you know, they make all kinds of other stuff, too. They make marine navigation, they make two-way radios, and they make a jump starter device, which this time of year, something like this is the kind of thing where maybe you don't really give much thought to this until you go out and your car doesn't start. Because, I don't know about you, but here today was like the first really bitterly cold day of winter. Is it really cold where you are?
Yeah, and, you know, Minnesota right now, I think, has negative 50-degree wind chill happening. So we don't have a lot of wind up here right now. We're up in the mountains, but it is 12 degrees outside.
Right. Yeah, it's bitterly cold. And this is the time of year, and I can remember when I came out to visit you in Montana, like hearing that sound all the way down the street every morning. As people are trying to get their cars to start. Well, they've got, well, I guess it's basically, to boil it quite down to what it is, it's like a mobile generator of sorts. You can jumpstart your car with it. If you want, you can take your TV and your Blu-ray down to the beach with you and power it off of this thing. They come in 3 different sizes. They're all easy to carry, easy to transport, and fits right into your trunk. And this is just one of, like the Cobra Tag, like the Cobra iRadar, like the Vedetta, like their marine navigation, their two-way radios, and all kinds of accessories to make your life, especially for people that live on the go, like Clayton and I, and maybe you too. This is what they do at Cobra Electronics. They're always at the forefront of this. I'm so excited to hear that their new iRadar is coming out in April. I can't wait to see the improvements that they've made, because they've always had that social component. They listen to what the users say, and they improve their products as a result. They use that type of information to constantly put themselves at the forefront, and that's why they're industry leaders. That's why they win all kinds of industry awards year in and year out. And don't just think of these kinds of things as gifts. Think of them as a practical investment for you and your family. Go over to Cobra Electronics at Cobra.com. I guarantee you there's something there for you. We couldn't make this show without them either. Thanks, Cobra.
Thanks, Cobra. Hey, I want to talk about this story I sent you the other day, and I think we both enjoyed it immensely. And, I've often thought, when you go to Disney, like, where are the Disney goons hiding, right? Are they often some...
the goons.
Right, the Goon Squad. You know, if you're doing something untoward, and I still haven't read that book that I bought on Disney, The Secret World of Disney.
Oh, yeah, I remember. You got that a while ago.
Yeah, I haven't, you know, just I started this book club, this history book club, and I've been reading these, like, massive, like, 600-page books every month, so...
That's too much, Clayton.
Finished up, like, Team of Rivals, the Lincoln book, and now I'm on Gettysburg, and then I've got, you know, God knows what I'll do next month, so...
You should read shorter books, Clayton.
Maybe I'll add that to the book club. The secret world of Disney. But, you know, there's this hidden world there, the, like, monitoring what's going on. As you're, you know, if you're causing a ruckus, if you got some crazy ugly t-shirt on with some swear words on it, some people are going to swoop in and make you put on like a Disney shirt or something because they don't want like swear words. You know, they have an eye in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
You got an underground network of stuff, and which makes this article all the more interesting about a guy in California who was down on his luck, had lost his job, basically no money, a filmmaker, I guess. I don't know if he
He had never directed a feature before, though.
So it was, you know, something he had wanted to do. And what did he do? He slapped together. He had a Canon camera, a low sort of a, you know, mid-range Canon camera, and with some sort of hidden, I think, GoPro cameras as well. I'm not sure. And guerrilla style, I guess he sort of mapped this whole thing out, storyboarded a whole script about how he was going to shoot a feature film inside the Disney parks without Disney knowing about it.
Right.
What is the guy's name? Do you happen to remember?
I don't. And you know what? I only read that article like 24 hours ago, and I really don't remember. But, basically, he and his team, across months and months, shot a whole feature film in the Disney parks without Disney ever knowing it. And it was fascinating reading how they went about doing this, that they had all the scripts on their cell phones so that if people walked past them as they were doing it, it would just look like they were, you know, people distracted by their cell phones. They would signal each other from different places in the park so it would never look like a crew was assembling all in one place. The one piece that I thought was interesting was, like, one of the scenes in the film required him to capture people getting off and on the monorails in a certain pattern.
Right.
And they had to board and, you know, deboard the monorails for hours because they couldn't figure out the timing pattern of when they arrived so he could get his shot right. So if for no other reason than the immense work of this group to get this done, which is, I don't know, like only enhanced by the fact that they somehow snuck around and did all this undetected on Disney property, makes this a fascinating idea.
Yeah, I love that they shot the sequences 25 days. It took them. So, I mean, I don't know how much in tickets that must have cost them, too, to get. Or maybe if you're in California, you have, like, the California pass, so you can go anytime. They went every day wearing the same clothes. All of their cast members went to the park the same day, day after day, wearing the same clothes. His name is Randy Moore. He was a down-on-his-luck mm-hmm. screenwriter. He was living in Burbank at the time. So pretty far from Disneyland. If you've never been, it's down in Orange County. Quite a little drive. Mm-hmm. He had just like a typical digital SLR camera. So it's amazing to me that they were able to like mic these individuals, get, you know, and create a storyline around the park setup. For instance, Escape from Tomorrow is the name of the movie, right? Mm-hmm. They say there's like, I guess they go through, they get off on certain areas like Tomorrowland. What are some of the locations? They use the backdrops of all of them and all of the different areas to kind of further the narrative, right?
Right. And, of course, if you were happen to be a guest at one of the Disney parks during the time that these people happen to be doing this, you're an unwitting extra in the film, which I thought was kind of an interesting thing as well.
Sure.
It's a very dark film. You know, what they said in this... what website ran that article? I don't even remember.
The LA Times wrote it, yeah.
Yeah, it was a very good article. But they said it's a very, very dark film. You know, it's about a guy who's really kind of down on his luck, and it's very depressing. It's a depressing film, and he wanted to juxtapose this very depressing narrative against a backdrop of what's often considered to be the happiest place on Earth, which everything I read about it in that piece just made me more and more curious to see it. And what they pointed out, of course, is that it probably will never see the light of day. It will be just buried under lawsuits from the Disney Corporation, who are so protective of the way that those kinds of, the way that their intellectual property is used, of course. If he'd gone to them up front looking for permission, of course, he never would have gotten it. And for this to ever see any kind of commercial release, it would have to fight a massive legal uphill battle in order to get it. Because, as I'm sure you saw in the article, one of the scenes is Epcot Center explodes.
Right. Yeah, which is not a good thing. I have to think, though, maybe Disney will take the unconventional approach to this, which is to say they may say, wait a second, this could be a PR nightmare if we decide to fight this thing. Mm-hmm. What if we do the opposite? What if we agree to buy the film? Mm-hmm. And what if we agree?
I think this is a very plausible thing. Go ahead. I know exactly what you're going to say.
You know, what if we decide to put this out? It becomes a Disney film. They've done, they've taken some risks before, certainly with the Pirates of the Caribbean films. Disney was taking some big risks with having a drunk Johnny Depp as the lead character and, all of those things. I mean, they could really do some interesting things here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it will be really interesting to see. Now, I'm sure, of course, as the creator of the film said, he said, it's going to live on in bootlegs and it'll be out there. And he said, that's all I wanted. I just wanted this story of mine to be out there in the world. And it is, because it was at Sundance, right? That's where they actually screened it.
Yeah, it's black and white film. It was shown for the first time at Sundance on Friday night, and it was prime. So that's those are the first folks that got a chance to see it. I think it's interesting that, he was living in fear for the last 3 years.
Right. The story about him going to South Korea to edit it just for fear of being discovered, I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, he told anyone who was working on the project they had to swear secrecy to it, that Disney could never learn word one of this thing. But it does, it does beg the question, though, what could they do? It's not illegal to bring a camera in there. It's not illegal to film your kids on rides. Is it? I guess it's, I don't know. I mean, could you take those photos and sell them? Like, if I were to go in there with my camera, well, I know, like, for instance, my buddy Trey Ratcliffe, who's a photographer, like, he'll go in there with his tripod set up and shoot some great, great shots. He sells them. Like, they'll be available, like, on his Smug Mug account to buy. He's got some really interesting shots of, like, the Haunted Mansion and that sort of stuff. Like, Disney doesn't own those. I mean, he's taking pictures of Disney architecture.
Right. Well, I think if he was going to try and sell those images commercially, he might have some trouble, because I would wager to say that Disney must somehow protect themselves in that way, right? Like, if you go into their park, they have people set up there that take your photo and sell it. Like, that's for Disney to monetize. That's their creation. So I think that's what he's up against, is that, he's done this without any kind of agreement, certainly without their permission, but with any kind of agreement with them. And, that's what he's going to be facing if he wants to try and release this commercially to make money. Now, the fact that, he's going around to film festivals, I'm sure, just based on the fervor coming out of Sundance, it's going to get screened some other places. But who knows what the fate of the film will be thereafter.
Yeah, I'd like to find out where we can see this thing, and if it's only going to be available online, if it's going to be out there on YouTube, because they're saying, we might never see it commercially. Where will this end up? Will it be something we'll have to, like, download, BitTorrent? He won't care. He'll put it out there on torrent sites for people to grab. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that may end up happening. The thing is, if you want to see this film, you'll be able to somehow.
Right. Unless this is, you were touching on something that I think is entirely possible, that Disney will buy it all up. Now, maybe this guy just won't sell. He won't, maybe to him, that's like making a deal with the devil. But not unlike, when Marvel bought that horrible Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie, basically so no one could ever see it. Maybe that's what Disney will do. They'll buy up everything, the masters, the whole nine yards, and it will just neatly disappear. And this guy will get a great payday out of it, but we'll never see it.
Right.
So I think that's a very distinct possibility.
Because I can't imagine they'd want to go through the legwork of trying to sue a guy who has no money. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, you just would want to sue him just to get your hands on the negatives, right? Just the film.
Right. Well, I don't think they'd sue him. I think they would just make him an offer, because, like you said, it could be a real PR nightmare. And Disney's so mindful of that, the way that they're presented in the public eye. Like,
right.
That they're persecuting this down on his luck, out of work, independent filmmaker. They're going to come off, somewhat villainous in the media.
Right.
So I think they'll probably take a different tack. They'll probably come in and say, hey, look, here's the kind of offer that a man with no income can't refuse, but we want everything related to that movie in case we decide to do something with it one day. And of course they won't. It'll go right into the vault with all of Walt Disney's, you know, pro-Nazi paraphernalia that they never want the world to see. And they'll lock the door.
I didn't realize it was also shot in Orlando. I've forgotten that that was also the case. He shot it in Anaheim, California, and also Orlando. So they shot some stuff. There's a Buzz Lightyear Space Ranger spin and Space Mountain scene. They go in the Tiki Room, the teacups, princesses, and the Main Street Parade at one point. And then, of course, as you mentioned, Epcot Center blows up at one point. I'm always fascinated by – I'm always – you know, the sort of hidden culture of Disney, of course. But I've always been fascinated by those old, like, 1950s and 60s films that were shot. That include a lot of Walt Disney talking and explaining his thoughts on the creation of Epcot Center. Have you ever seen those classic films on Epcot Center?
Well, I have, like, at the park, you know, like, they have rooms that you can go into where there's, like, a 5-minute multimedia presentation where it's, you know, him describing the experimental prototypical city of tomorrow or whatever it is exactly that acronym stands for. And
right.
Yeah, I have kind of a strange nostalgic affinity for that.
Disney released those as like these metal tinned box sets a few years ago. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to see those. My buddy Brad, who was a huge Disney aficionado, and he would lend them to me. You know, they had them all for different characters, which I think you can buy at the Disney stores down there. At the parks and the big Disney store. Over at like the Disney Boardwalk, they have those big metal tinned DVDs, and I guess with the move towards digital, I don't know if they have those anymore. But maybe they're collector's sets. I don't know. But they're in these. Let's see, what is it? Epcot 30th anniversary. I'm trying to look this up on Amazon here. But they had one. You could get them, and they had like, you know, a book and liner notes inside. And they had like 2 or 3 DVDs inside. You could buy them for, you know, like the Donald Duck collection, and it'd be like in a metal tin, and you'd get, like every Donald Duck cartoon. You could buy like the Goofy tin, you know, get all, you know, all those cartoons, those classic ones. You could get, they had a whole list. I got to find those and find out what they were called. But they had an Epcot one just specifically to, I think just specific to Epcot. Or maybe it was like Tomorrowland or something. I don't know, but it was a tin devoted to that, and you had like multiple DVDs, and I watched them all and devoured them. And of course, you get to see all the behind the scenes of the building of Epcot, the whole documentary. It has the whole full video of Walt Disney explaining his thoughts for Epcot, and it's like a half hour. And he goes through, and it shows like the cars moving. It shows how we're going to get food and resources into this city. It's how we're going to live, you know, in this bio chamber, and it's going to be the most efficient city in the world. And here, this land here is all orange groves at this point. So it's an extrapolation, I think, of that 5-minute thing that you were talking about at the parks. Mm-hmm. It goes, and I love it. It's fascinating to me. And in fact, if you've seen Iron Man 2, you know the scenes where it's showing Tony Stark's father.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To me, it's like completely reminiscent of that. It's as if they swiped it from that. Like he's Walt Disney and standing in front of that giant, you know, map explaining what he's working on with that like slight film grain and this slightly futuristic looking room that he's in. I just love that stuff. Just eat that stuff up.
Right on. Hey, movie relevant, some stuff that I cribbed recently from our friends over at superherohype.com, a site that I often comb for information about all things superhero. A couple quick things that I saw over there that caught my attention. You know, in this year, upcoming, big, big summer for superhero films this year, one of the most anticipated, certainly it's been winning polls everywhere, you know, what are people most interested to see, even trumping Iron Man 3, has been The Man of Steel, the Superman reimagining. And one of the things that's kind of come out is that while there is no character being called Jimmy Olsen in the movie, there is a Jenny Olsen. And people who, you know, put their protests up when it was announced that Lawrence Fishburne would be playing Perry White, which is typically a white dude, and Lawrence Fishburne is not a white dude. are also up in arms because now they've changed the role of Jimmy Olsen to being female, or at least that's what people seem to think based on the fact that an actress, what's her name? Let me get this for you quick here. It's Rebecca something. Rebecca Buller is playing Jenny Olsen. So people are speculating, of course, that that role has been switched too. And, you know, I don't know that I really care about that. Like, if she's a good actress, and of course Lawrence Fishburne's a good actor, like, who really cares? You know,
yeah,
like,
who cares if they mix
I don't
these
have such
things?
An attachment to Perry White that I'm like, oh, that dude, like, who cares? As long as it's a good actor, who gives a crap?
You mean you don't care if it's a female?
Right, like, I have no attachment to Jimmy Olsen. I don't care if it's a guy or a girl.
Right.
In the same way, I have no attachment to Perry White. Like,
do you mind the,
yeah, either way, I don't care about that.
Do you mind
but
the
I know some people have really been out of shape about it.
Well, I think it's the same thing. It's like the canon, right? I mean, it was what drove people nuts about Spider-Man not having web shooters in that first trilogy with Sam Raimi. You know, he has web shooters.
They pulled it off.
Yeah. I didn't care. And, you know, you think about, like, in the first Batman films, Harvey Dent.
Right, yeah, Billy Dee Williams played him.
I mean, and Samuel L. Jackson playing Nick Fury.
Well, there was a precedent for that in the books, because in the Ultimates, he was drawn to be Samuel L. Jackson. And,
right.
But again, he's great in that role. Like, it's not like I watch it and I'm like, that's not Nick Fury. No, I don't think that at all.
Yeah.
And Nick Fury, like Perry White and Jimmy Olsen, is not somebody I'm really all that attached to.
Right.
You know? Like, different. I'll give you, well, this is kind of an obvious one, but like, if Captain America was being played by, I don't know, like, Jet Li.
Right.
I think I'd be like, eh.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that I buy that, you know, but.
He's Asian. Well, he's Asian American. Oh, all right. Just for the sake of doing it, like, that's what you're sort of, I'm like, why are you doing this? Everyone knows the canon of Sherlock Holmes and Watson, right? Dr. Watson, they're a male, you know, male. Now you got this elementary show on you know, American television.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever her name is, Lisa Ling is playing the,
Lucy Liu?
Or Lucy Liu playing the Watson character.
Mm-hmm. Lana Lang?
Lana Lang.
Mm-hmm. Lois Lane? Lori Lamoris?
Yeah.
You know, Clayton, I think when people get to the end of this episode, this is going to be their takeaway, that we're racist.
What?
That's going to be the takeaway.
It's taken this long to figure that out.
Yeah. I also thought this was really interesting from SuperheroHype.com. About 2 weeks ago, I think it was, there was a script leaked that seems to be what they're going to be doing with the new Justice League film. And I don't have time to sit and read a script.
Right.
You know? Like, as curious as I would be, I don't have time to sit and read a script. But it does seem like, based on what's out there, that the movie is the big seven of the Justice League. And to clarify what I mean by that, they're the seven heavy hitters of the Justice League. Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Flash, Green Lantern, and those five were no surprise. Every other version of this script that people have rumored about, talked about, or even has been leaked out, including that one from years ago where the Flash gets killed in the third act, have all had those five in it. But this has the other two of the big seven, Aquaman and the Martian Manhunter.
Oh, nice.
Who had never previously appeared in other versions of the script that had been out there or that people had heard rumors about. So there was immense excitement about this. That to me is kind of like the quintessential group. Like, you need them. Like, in my mind, you don't need Black Canary. I know there's some people that are like, it's got to have Black Canary. I don't care about Black Canary. It doesn't need Black Canary. It doesn't need, you know what I mean? Like, there's some of those other characters that people like, it's got to have the Atom. Like, I can live without the Atom. But if they had ignored Aquaman, like, that would have really bothered me, because he's easy to ignore, right? Like, he's
right.
I think people get caught up in the whole idea, like, he's got to be in the water. Like, that's the only way you can do Aquaman. And if they're doing the Justice League, Aquaman needs to be there. The Martian Manhunter, eh, I could leave or take. But
I'm just fearful, though, of an Aquaman inclusion. It's going to end up, you know, there's going to be that obligatory, like, water scene only because we have to include him, get in some action. Right? Mm-hmm. How could he be useful? Because if you watch, like, Justice League Unlimited, which we just started watching this week, I really enjoy it. Like, Martian Manhunter plays, like, this advisory role. Like, right, he's calling the shots from space. He's sending – he's like, all right, on this mission, we need to send Green Arrow. We need to send – you know, we need to send Supergirl, and we need to send Batman, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, why can't I go? Because that's who I'm telling is going on this mission. right? I can't ever, and I was thinking about this as I'm watching Martian Manhunter dole out job resources. Like, all right, this one involves, you know, figuring out a spacecraft that's crash landed in the ocean. Who do we send? Well, there's one person you send for that one, right?
Right.
Maybe Batman and his Batboat. Other than that, you guys all take a rest. But I'm just afraid there's going to be that one scene that you know they shoved in there just so they could get some Aquaman action, right? He needs to go down undersea to investigate what's going on just to make it happen. And I feel like they might squeeze it in, you know?
Yeah. Well, two-thirds of the world's surface is covered with water, to be fair.
That's true.
But, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. Justice League Unlimited, which is very, very good. I know we've talked about that recently. That Unlimited, which is the final two seasons of that franchise, of the total of four that they made, the Martian Manhunter's really active in the first two seasons before it becomes Unlimited. And then they have this big kind of thing that goes down. And when you get in at Justice League Unlimited, there are some things that you'll notice. One is Hawkgirl doesn't wear her costume anymore. I don't know if she's appeared yet in any of the episodes you watch. She just wears like a yellow jumpsuit.
No, I didn't see that yet.
And the Martian Manhunter doesn't leave the satellite. He stays at the watchtower in space. And that'll come up later. The more episodes that you watch, I think Wonder Woman confronts him about it, like why he won't leave the watchtower anymore. And they do some really kind of like long-term interesting characterization. I think the Martian Manhunter generally, except during the run where he was written by Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis, both of whose names I'm not sure I'm saying right, during the 80s Justice League International run, when like he was like the straight man that liked to stay home and watch sitcoms and eat Oreo cookies, the Martian Manhunter, aside from that, is always the least interesting member of the Justice League to me. I don't care about the Martian Manhunter. And you know, people that love the Martian Manhunter, one of the things they like to point out is he is, in many ways, the most powerful member of the Justice League. He can do all the same things Superman can do, plus turn invisible, he's a shapeshifter, and he's telepathic. Like, he's unstoppable. The Martian Manhunter should be in the field for every mission, because if anything ever goes wrong, who can stop the Martian Manhunter? Like, he's just super powerful. But I think he's boring. I hate the Martian Manhunter. He doesn't interest me at all. So there was a poll online at superherohype.com where people were asking, who are you most looking forward to seeing in the Justice League movie? And, of course, there's no doubt that Superman, Wonder Woman, and Batman are the most, you know, of course, they're the big three of DC Comics. Those are the ones that people are most interested to see. And then I thought, in my mind, the next character to get votes is going to be Green Lantern, right? He's got to be the next. He's the most out there. You see those T-shirts everywhere. Green Lantern. Well, Green Lantern actually came in last in the poll. People are far more interested to see Aquaman than they are Green Lantern.
Is it because of the bad taste Ryan Reynolds film?
I think that has a lot to do with it. I think that one really, you know, hurt the Green Lantern franchise to the point where Green Lantern came in dead last, just 1.3%.
Have you seen that, by the way? I know you hadn't yet for a while. Did you ever get around to seeing the Green Lantern movie?
I did, and I did not hate it. I wasn't like, oh my God, this is it. But I didn't hate it. Like, yeah. I read so many negative reviews that just bashed it, and I didn't hate it. Like, I didn't necessarily like it a whole lot, but I didn't hate it either.
Yeah.
But I thought that was really interesting. Like, I think that's exactly what it is. The Ryan Reynolds Green Lantern has damaged that character so much in the public eye. I know they're doing a very good animated series on Cartoon Network. And Cartoon Network's also doing an outstanding series called Young Justice, which has, like, every DC character you can possibly think of showing up in it. Hmm. And it's excellent. It's really, really good. But I was so pleased to see, like, 10% of people responded, like, Aquaman's the one they're interested to see. Because if they get the right writer on it, and I don't think they've announced who it is that's doing the final write of the script or whatever. If he's done right, Aquaman can be very, very compelling. And when he's treated as a joke or when the writers are lazy, you know, you kind of get, like, Super Friends Aquaman, which is what you're talking about, like, you know, the space invasion happens, and the first thing they do is they all crash into the ocean so Aquaman can go out and see what's up.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break here. And here is the moment you've been waiting for. We're telling you how you can win a Google Nexus 7 tablet. We're going to tie it together with our good friends over at Tonks Coffee. I just made myself – I have a big pot. I made a little French press here of my some of my Tonks coffee beans this morning. These are from Rwanda. And these are delicious. They're from a cooperative down there, the Dunkade Co-op in Rwanda. And these beans are fantastic. You know what's interesting I've noticed about Tonks beans? I was just talking with my wife the other day about it because she loves this coffee. She's not a coffee drinker. She'll drink like lattes or she'll drink, she's mostly tea, but because when I make Tonks coffee, she drinks it. And she doesn't want to even get it out at restaurants anymore because it's so good when we make it at home with these beans. But there's like a sheen to other beans. Like if you buy, mm-hmm. I don't know if you've noticed that. Like in the store, you'll see like a bag of beans and it'll have like this like shininess to them.
Right, of course.
But Tonks beans don't have that. Have you noticed that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've noticed that in the bags or not, but they have like a matte finish to the beans.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's because they're just not putting, they don't put stuff on it to like preserve it. They don't need to because it's freshly roasted and sent right to your door. Where it's not having to sit on shelves for a long time with the fear of it then like turning rancid. But I noticed that. I saw like a bag when we were at the store the other day, like a big bag of beans, and it had like this like sheen to the beans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that's from.
I don't know. But, you know, it's exactly that sort of thing, like the aging process that makes the, you know, you end up with bitter coffee as a result. And you never have to worry about that with Tonks because their job one is getting these things to you fresh. They are sealed within 24 hours and sent directly to you so that you're getting the freshest possible beans. Only way to get them fresher, Clayton, is to go out and pick them yourself. And I don't know about you, but I rarely go to Rwanda.
Yeah, I don't have my own coffee field handy.
Mm-hmm.
So check them out. Go to Tonks, TONX.org, to sign up for some free coffee. You can do a trial. For free. You just type in your credit card info. That's just, you know, if you want to continue your subscription with them, and why wouldn't you? Crying out loud. So good. You can check from different plans that get sent to you. And you're saving money, right? I mean, what were the numbers we had on here like a week ago or so about the amount of money people are spending on coffee out at stores? I mean, it's absurd, you know, how much money you end up saving, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we saw that. I don't know who it was that had published that.
The consumerist?
Yeah, it was the consumerist. You're exactly right. They said, on average, the American worker spends $1,476 per year on coffee. $1,476 per year on coffee. So if you're looking to cut that down, I think you might want to go over to Tonks.org, and we're going to sweeten the deal for you as it relates to maybe getting your hands on a Galaxy Nexus tablet device by Google.
Yeah, so over the next 4 weeks, you'll have 4 weeks to do this, but why not start now? So go to Tonks. Here's the three-part process that you need to do. Sign up for a free account. So go to Tonks.org and sign up for a free trial of their coffee. And when you get it, you're never going to go back to other beans. I'm telling you, you get that little bag in the mail, you're going to say, ooh, this is delicious coffee. Grind it up at home, make it yourself. You'll never be the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's step one. Sign up for your free trial of Tonks coffee. Then follow Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter. Drop the egg out of the title. Just follow at Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Sorry, Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter. And then what you simply need to do is, after you've signed up for your free trial of coffee, followed us on Twitter, all you need to do is send a tweet. And what should the tweet say?
Well, you're definitely going to want to mention our friends at Tonks Coffee. All is one word, TONXCOFFEE. That's really important. And mention us. Mention your friends here at the Grizz, too.
Yeah. Just to, you know, say, hey, we just signed up for our free trial of Tonks coffee. Thanks to the guys at the Grizzly Bear Cafe. That's all you need to say. Go ahead and use the hashtag Grizz if you want. But we'll look through all of those. We'll look through all of those tweets. And then we'll confer with our friends over at Tonks to see if you sign up for the free trial or not. Just to make sure that we're all on the up and up. And once you've done that, we'll enter at random. You're entered at random for a chance to win that Google Nexus 7 tablet. And what we'll do after 4 weeks, a month, we will announce the winner 4 shows from now. So just simply do that on Twitter. Sign up for your free trial and you're entered. It's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
So our thanks to Tonks, delicious coffee. I made myself a little French press full of it right here while I'm doing the Grizz, and it is delicious. I'm going to take a swig.
Mm. Whenever you drop off the program for a few moments, I always wonder, I'm like, did I lose the call? Or is Clayton just drinking his Tonks?
And I brought the bag of beans down here, and my son asks to smell it in the morning when I make the beans. Daddy, can I smell the coffee? So I've gotten him to develop a bit of a coffee palate. His smell, he loves it. He said, that's good, Daddy.
There was once a like a bed and breakfast type place I had stayed in Montana that in the morning, like the breakfast was being prepared, of course, before you'd wake up. The cabin was filled with the smell of coffee and bacon.
Oh,
and I was like, this is ideal.
Right.
You can charge me any price for this. And if someone makes like an air freshener that's that, coffee and bacon, we should talk. That was my sideways pitch to get to that.
Hey, have you had a chance yet to see, it's on Netflix now. You can watch, I think, the first two seasons of it on Netflix. And it's been out there on my list of shows to watch. And I hadn't had a chance because there were so many other good shows to catch up on. But so many people talking about the show Downton Abbey.
Wow. I only first heard of this like in the last week or so. And, you know, I don't have a Netflix subscription anymore. I do have Hulu Plus. But, no. So you watched one or you have not?
We watched the pilot episode of Downton. And, you know, I was mispronouncing it for so long. I just never paid attention that there was a W missing out of the name. I thought it was Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always see my friends on Twitter and so forth talking about how they can't wait to watch Downton Abbey tonight on whatever they're excited for it. And I'm just like, oh, this is another show now I need to add to my list. And it seemed like up my alley, you know, something that's sort of early 1900s London or, you know, England and palace intrigue, a little history thrown into the mix. It seemed like right up my alley.
Mm-hmm.
And, we watched the pilot episode the other night, and I would think it might be on Hulu Plus also. It's all over the place. It's PBS, so it's all over the place. But it is a PBS show. And it first aired on ITV over in the United Kingdom back in 2010, and then, of course, PBS here in the States starting in 2011 as part of their Masterpiece Classic anthology. And, you know, I don't really watch much on PBS. The only thing I get, you know, of course, my son will watch a little bit of Sesame Street here and there, but I watch the news.
4 hours of Nova every night.
Nova's great. I forgot about that. Oh, yeah, and Frontline. Frontline is fantastic documentaries. You ever watch Frontline? Really good stuff.
And what that is guy's, Frontline?
Frontline is like a weekly hour and a half long documentary series. And they'll do just different subjects, you know, like meth in America. And
okay. Oh, yeah, I think now that you're saying that about the meth, yeah.
Then they'll do, I don't know. They've done all sorts of great, great pieces over the years. And you can watch, you know, I think there's actually a free, in fact, oh, I know where you can watch this. On your iPad for free. There's a PBS app, free PBS app on your iPad. Yeah. And you can watch like any show you can think of on there, like all the Nova shows. You can go back and watch all of the PBS shows. I know that Downton Abbey is on the PBS app, so forget Hulu Plus. You can watch it there. Anyway, we watched the pilot episode the other night, and it is great. It just sucks you in. It takes place, and I was asking my wife, and I don't know if you know the answer to this or not. When did the United Kingdom abandon and move to the parliamentary? The parliamentary system, the House of Commons, and the Prime Minister taking the lead. Was it? I don't know my. I'm ashamed to say I don't know my UK history as well as I should, because this takes place before that. This takes place in 1912, and it sort of opens with the sinking of the Titanic, and it takes place at the Abbey, Downton Abbey, and the Lord who runs this Abbey. It still has all sort of medieval, medieval aristocracy and power, sort of the British, social hierarchy of the time. And he still has this, he still has all the power in this particular, he's the lord of this particular area of England. So, you know, if someone's going to be, sentenced or for a crime, like he has the power to pull the police in and put someone behind bars if he wanted to. It doesn't move to this sort of parliamentary system for, I think, a while, right? I mean, is it
Do you know the answer, or are you really asking me?
I'm really asking you. I don't know. I don't know. I know that, obviously, Winston Churchill, World War II, he certainly was the prime minister and had the power.
Right.
And the king, you know, the queen and the king at the time did not. They were figureheads. They had been moved to – the monarchy had been moved to a figurehead position. And, of course, the House of Lords still has a very weak vote. You know, like Elton John's a lord. If you're knighted, you become a lord, right? Paul McCartney technically can vote in the House of Lords. They never do because it's mostly just figurehead. But I don't – you know, the House of Commons is where the real legislation takes place. And, of course, the prime minister. But, you know, mostly the monarchy is mostly, obviously, figurehead. But it wasn't then. And that's where the series takes place, 1912. It is really, really well done. You're sucked into this life of the servants who live in this house. And, you know, it becomes a tale of two classes, really. You know, you have the you have the social sort of struggle within the house. You have the valet. You have the footman, the butler, the maids all scurrying about, and you know the sort of the gossip that they employ throughout the show and back and forth, and who's this and who's this new guy coming in here to work for us, and we don't want him to, you know, be the one that handles the Lord's newspapers. Why do we need to, you know, why must the newspapers be ironed every morning? Well, and, you know, like the maid shoots back, well, you don't want the Lord's hands to be black, do you? So they like, you know, they there's someone who irons his newspapers in the morning. And the Titanic sets the precedent for the show, and because two of their heirs to Downton Abbey were on the Titanic. And you don't know what happens to them. So now there's like this mad scramble to try to find another male heir in the family. And how far must they look across England to try to find this like distant cousin who may now be the heir to the throne, or not the throne, but the you know, to the power in Downton Abbey. Fascinating, really fascinating stuff, and really well done by Julian Fellowes, who created it. And it's you know, it has more viewers. It had more viewers, 14 million viewers, than Mad Men. And it just ended its third season, I guess, the other night. So it's won like all kinds of has the Guinness World Records as the most critically acclaimed English language television series of 2011. We did a segment on it this weekend on the show, just asking the question, how has this British show, a period piece set in 1912, become a huge American hit? You know, can you imagine pitching that to PBS? You're like going to create a show. You go to PBS. You're like, how about this for an American show? Let's do a British show, you know, a British fictional drama about some, you know, an aristocracy from 1912. And let's see if it'll be a hit. And it has. It's been a runaway hit. So
And it is. It's made here in the U.S.?
I believe it is. I mean, I'm sure it's shot there, right? Locations. It's shot in Highclere Castle in Hampshire. It's used for the exterior shots. Most of the interior filming are filmed at Ailing Studios. Let me see this. Where is this at? Ailing Studios in West London. So yeah, it's a lot of the studios, yeah. So these are BBC owned studios, but so it's shot, you know. But it is PBS funded, so it is an American show. It's not a BBC show, which is what I thought it was. I thought for sure that this was a BBC show that just finally came here. But no, it's a bigger hit here because it's produced for in the United States. We watched the second episode last night. Better than the first. I mean, it just gets good and. Yeah, people are saying like, oh, the first season's great, second season's excellent, third season you're just like sucked in, and I think the season finale was the other night, to great critical acclaim. So, again, good show, jolly good show.
Interesting. Well, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah,
I'm interested to check it out. Hey, excuse me, I meant to bring this up earlier when we were talking about Yes, and I forgot to. Back in 2006. Susanna Hoffs, who you know is the lead singer of the Bangles back in the 80s, and you know they're back together. They got back together several years ago, and they still tour, and every once and again I think they record together. Well, in between being with the Bangles, Susanna Hoffs teams up with 90s alt-rocker Matthew Sweet. And they were originally releasing things under the name Sid and Susie, but I think somebody finally pressured them to just call it Matthew Sweet and Susanna Hoffs for commercial reasons. And back in 2006, they released an album called Under the Covers Volume 1, which was all covers of songs that they loved from the 1960s, including Different Drum, which is how it came to my attention. Different Drum, which they knew because it was, you know, it was taken to number one by Linda Ronstadt and the Stone Ponies, but written by Michael Nesmith, perhaps the most discussed person on this podcast. Well, then, just 2 years ago, they released a Volume 2, which I didn't realize, which is all covers of 70s songs, including Secondhand News by Fleetwood Mac, There Goes My Girl by Tom Petty, and I've Seen All Good People by Yes, among many others. They did Beware of Darkness, the George Harrison track, all kinds of really good stuff. And while every once and again there's a song on there that's kind of wah-wah, for the most part, these are excellent, excellent albums. And I was really excited to learn that the rumor is that later this year, a Volume 3 of them covering all their favorite 80s songs is coming.
That's
which
cool.
I would be very, very interested to hear. Because Volume 1 of 60s songs and Volume 2 of 70s songs have both been excellent. And you can check them out and listen to like 90-second previews of each of the songs in iTunes if you want. Matthew Sweet and Susanna Hoffs. And like I said, 95% of it is excellent, excellent stuff. They do a really, really good job. And I don't know how those two became friends. I don't know any of that that story, which would be very interesting to know more about. But in my high school days, I was quite the Matthew Sweet fan. He had a string of albums that I really, really liked. And then he just kind of faded away, like almost into obscurity, even though he's religiously been releasing albums every 2 to 3 years. He's released 13 studio albums. So he does stay very busy, Matthew Sweet. It just seems like, you know, he had that early success when Girlfriend was like a big smash in the days of like 120 minutes on MTV. And then Altered Beast, with one of my very, very favorite songs called Time Capsule, by Matthew Sweet. And then it seemed like after his follow-up to that was called 100% Fun, it just seemed like his commercial success just faded away really quickly. Even though he's continued to make quality music for all these years, it almost seems like, you know, he just faded from the popular consciousness.
That's cool. Hey, some follow-up here. Wayne McCarty says, let your kids watch Star Wars Episode 1 through 3. The kids love Jar Jar. Wayne, it's not going to happen. Alliston Fernando agrees with you on the bumper sticker issue. Love the podcast, and I agree that Twitter will kill the bumper sticker, hopefully. John Gruber writes us, a great show. I know for a fact you have fans on the SM team at O, stage management team at O, the Cirque du Soleil show, and at the new MJ show, the Michael Jackson show, which is different than the tour. John writes us from Montreal, Quebec. Yeah, very interesting. I'd be curious, John, maybe write us and tell us how it is different.
Right, yeah. I just figured it would be like an entrenched version of the Immortal show. I had no idea that it was going to be different.
Yeah. Kenneth Blake writes, as I get older, I appreciate the Grizz even more. Feel free to chuck extras our way. Well, happy to. Hey, we're chucking you an extra right now, which is that free Google Nexus tablet. Sign up for it. Yeah, I had a friend of ours write. She is the stage management, part of the stage management team from O, and said that anytime we wanted to come and visit, she would love to have us. So excited about that.
That's the best offer we've had today.
Yeah, yeah.
Now we just got to get to Vegas.
Yeah, that's what I said. So next time I'm there, we are definitely going to see O together. We should do a little road trip sometime.
Little road trip. That's a big road trip.
Yeah. And hey, did you see the link I just sent you?
Before? You sent me a link, did you?
Yeah, I sent you a link. We'll round out the show with this. Unless you have any other stuff you want to chat about.
What, this Walt Disney Treasures thing?
Yeah, that's what it's called. See these tins of Walt Disney Treasures?
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah,
the whole series of them. So this particular one, and they come in these sort of metal tins. You can buy them on Amazon. They're $24. Walt Disney Treasures Collections, Tomorrowland, Disney in Space and Beyond from 1959. So this is the one that I was referring to. Before man ventured into space, Disney took the nation there. This set of Disney treasures consists of science factual shows that aired mostly in the 1950s from the Disney Network on the first disc. You get three 50-minute segments on space travel, going to the moon and going to Mars. You get some lectures and different things by a rocket designer. Then you get the sort of, how the satellites work and all that sort of stuff. The stuff that I think was airing at Disney Studios at the time, or stuff that maybe was airing on television by Disney. And then you get some of the Epcot stuff for his the informative pitch on the Epcot Center pitch from Walt Disney himself. Hmm. And he talks about it as the city of the future. But there's a whole series of them. As I was scrolling through looking at them, you can see they have a whole history of like Disneyland USA. Mm-hmm. So I guess that goes through and shows you Disneyland, how it changed everything. And Leonard Maltin hosts a lot of these. That's right. Hmm. So there's a whole series of them. Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, Tinkerbell collection, like all of them. Whatever you want, you can probably get it in these Masters collections or these Treasures collections. Mm-hmm. Kind of neat.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Hey, upcoming here, when we're not busy making podcasts, which Clayton and I do with some frequency, you can catch us out and about in the real world, not just in the potosphere. For example, if you turned on your television to the Fox News Network on the weekends, you'll see my man Clayton Morris hosting Fox and Friends. That's live TV served up straight from Clayton to you every single weekend, and sometimes during the week when they need him. So catch him over on the Fox News Network. If you'd like to come out and see me live, well, you can do so even this weekend. For example, upcoming for me, I've got Wrestling is Respect in Boonton, New Jersey. You can catch me there. Next weekend, February 2nd, is National Pro Wrestling Day. It's a day-long festival celebrating the sport we all love, and it's absolutely free to attend. Come on down to the Derby Inc. Gardens, where I'm going to lock up with fellow podcaster and pro wrestler Colt Cabana. That's at National Pro Wrestling Day. We're on the afternoon card that starts at 1 o'clock p.m. But the entire festival, all 20 matches, are free to attend. If you can't be there to see it live, well, you can order the pay-per-view at smvod.com. And the very next weekend is the start of Season 12 of Chikara. You can catch me in Reading, Pennsylvania, and Easton, PA. Details on those cards at chikarapro.com.
Cool beans, my friend. Good luck to the kickoff of the season. I'm excited to hear all about that. All that and so much more we will be chatting about probably on the next edition of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Don't forget to sign up for your free trial of Tonks Coffee. Our thanks to our other sponsor, Cobra Electronics. We'll see you next week, everyone.
Adios, amigos.